This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, we're talking about various issues having to do with policing today. Our guest is Chief Sylvia Moyer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You are here because you were introduced to me as a police chief who will speak candidly. I said, well, that's a rarity. I'm not turning that one down. So we'll let the reader, we'll let the listener judge by the end of the show. So,
I'm sure they will judge.
So you've been in Tempe 3 years. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to policing and where you've worked, and just give us a little about you.
Sure, Mike. I spent 28 years in policing in California, where I really learned about dealing with the complexities, engaging in the complexities with an urban environment in Sacramento, with all of the things that occur in the complex environment of urban policing. And I was a police chief for just over 5 years in El Cerrito in the San Francisco Bay Area. All of that really gave me the experience and the perspective, the humility for sure, about being a police executive in today's society. And I brought all of that here to Tempe. I guess it's also appropriate that I talk about, you know, what started was the values in my family, a family whose values were to contribute, leave things better than I found them, and to add value to wherever I was. Also, some education, so a bachelor's degree and a couple graduate degrees that really helped me understand at a different level all of the things that are engaged in policing.
Did you have police work in your family?
So that's a great question. I do. I have had a great uncle and an uncle that were with the Oakland, California Police Department. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about that, Mike, is I didn't have a concept of entering policing until far later.
But you majored in criminal justice, suggesting that was on your mind or something. That's usually, and I say this as somebody who, I taught criminal justice at ASU for a couple of years. So,
thanks for your service with that and framing the minds of people, influencing the minds of people. It wasn't until after I went on a ride along with a female Sacramento police officer that I then changed my major and changed to criminal justice. Uh-huh. And that's where I really was influenced to engage in policing. It was an exciting and interesting experience, and I was wholly committed from that experience onward.
So a ride-along did it.
It did. Yeah. As funny as that sounds, it was a ride-along.
No, it doesn't surprise me because I think of like doctors, priests, and police officers see people in kind of with the behind the curtains. They see them in their kind of most critical moments, and that is inherently an interesting phenomenon.
Sure. And in policing, for me, pulling back that curtain and seeing the variety of police calls for service and self-initiated contacts that that officer engaged in throughout that shift made me clearly understand humanity and how police officers could engage with people to safeguard from others, to comfort, and to provide an array of service that was before then unknown to me.
Differences, California and Tempe, in styles of policing, expectations of the community, but mostly in the departments. Is there a cultural difference? And you were in more than one California department.
I was in a few. And so it gave me this really interesting perspective. When we're talking about differences, I think I can start with what police officers do across this country is the same, irrespective
of
where they serve.
The task is the same.
Sure. It's safeguarding people. It's reducing harm. It is reducing crime and the fear of crime. So where one does that is very similar. Why we do it, the calling to safeguard people, the higher necessity to hold people accountable to the rule of law, that why and wanting to contribute is the same. What differs, and although slightly, is the how we do it. It's the execution of the task and how a specific department's culture influences how officers engage with the community. So there are slight differences, but surprisingly, they're not as enormous as one would think.
Now, cultural differences. That's really your job, isn't it?
Many ways, as an
I mean, this is a hierarchical organization that who defines the culture, I think, in Tempe? You do.
Sure, and I distinguish it in this way. Culture lasts for generations. It is this overarching kind of long-lasting way that folks in the organization engage. I think what is more pliable, what is more, I think, rapid to change through one's influence is climate. And I distinguish them like this. Climate is what life looks like, sounds like, feels like in the organization. So I think as an executive, I have, and as a police chief, I have more of a rapid ability to influence climate. And that is really important. Because if we influence climate in this short span of time, I assert, and some would argue, that then the culture will follow when it's done, the climate is altered, aligned with higher values.
Now, that's all very theoretical. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Absolutely. So what life looks like in the organization and sounds like might be a little bit different now than when I joined the Tempe team 3 years ago. And with there is no disparagement on any former administration. But there are evolutions that occur. An evolution that will illustrate this for the listeners is the climate in the Tempe Police Department has broader permission for officers to express how they feel in times of anguish, for instance. We have a broad permission for officers to seek aid, seek counseling, seek those services that help them prepare for the traumas in policing.
In the old days, that used to be a black mark. You didn't do it. You had to suck it up or there was something the matter with you.
The old days, it was suck it up and drive on, kid. Mm-hmm. And now we recognize the effects of the acute, chronic, and cumulative toxicity and stress of first responders when we're engaged with people in times of trauma, suffering, and it is very, very difficult for folks. So the climate in the Tempe Police Department is speak up, say something. We have an array of services to support cops and how they engage with folks before a call, during a call, and after a call to build their resilience. So if listeners get anything out of climate being more rapid in terms of change, it is that part of it, the organization looks and sounds a little bit different than it did a few years ago.
Okay, we'll be back with Tempe Police Chief Sylvia Moyer in just a moment when we pick up things in the think tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We were talking about sort of police resiliency. I mean, obviously, you know, individual officers from time to time encounter some pretty horrific stuff. And traditionally, and I think some of the older listeners of the show know it, I spent a year as a police officer in Baltimore, early 70s. And we didn't do, you know, the point that or the mode then was suck it up and continue. Otherwise, you just weren't cut out for it. I listened to a really interesting interview that you did on the radio on mindfulness, which you could explain and tell us how that relates to the issues of resiliency and the like.
Sure. I think we've recognized that the law enforcement culture defines some coping mechanisms for the ambiguous and unpredictability of the work. It also has a gap. We've recognized there's a gap in really identifying those skills that an officer could use to more appropriately take in more data at a scene. So, for instance, mindfulness is just being aware of what is coming up for you in each individual in a certain circumstance and having a consciousness around that. I often say for folks that in the policing realm, it's taking that Viktor Frankl piece, and between stimulus and response lies choice. And what we're doing is we're teaching officers skills of breathing and some other real skills so that they can be fully present given the stimulus that is before them to take in more data and make an appropriate and measured response for each situation. We think that the practices of mindfulness strengthen officers in a tactical realm because they are less likely to react and more likely to respond.
Explain the difference.
So a react is just that intuitive, quick thinking. Mm-hmm. A response is more contemplative. And I think Daniel Kahneman talked about this in his book of Thinking Fast and Slow. And he described a System 1 and System 2 brain. System 1, System 2 thinking. It's that immediate reaction response. It's that intuitive, mm-hmm. which is necessary in a lot of environments. But what we're saying is many of the environments that an officer is thinking and reacting to might be more appropriately responded to through a more contemplative brain. We believe that mindfulness is a pathway to take in more data and make appropriate responses because we understand what is coming up for us, we pay attention to it, and we respond to the unfolding experience more thoughtfully.
Does this relate at all? It sure seems like it would. And does your department do specific de-escalation training? When you got circumstances, there's contention between two parties. And by de-escalation, I mean conscious strategies to try to diffuse situations.
Yeah, no doubt we do. We believe wholly in de-escalation. And I think we go back to when I joined policing in 1988, we were teaching what was called then combat breathing. This might resonate with you. Combat breathing was, in essence, to take a deep breath so you can clear your mind and take in more data to then have an appropriate response. That has evolved with research and science that informs that breathing and paying attention to what emotions come up is helpful for an officer because then they make an appropriate and measured response. De-escalation is absolutely a part of that. It is reducing the probability of a force encounter between a police officer and a member of the public. And we believe that it has to be researched. And we have teamed in Tempe with academic researchers with ASU through a grant through the Bureau of Justice Assistance to study over 3 years what gives rise to those officers that are determined to use less force, use appropriate levels of force given the resistance they're encountering, and have less complaints, less injuries. And so we're studying that. We believe it starts with managing oneself to reduce the probability of a force encounter and then managing the situation through rapport building, voice, physical presence, and a number of things.
That's funny. I think the extent of de-escalation training I got was that if you were told it in the middle of a certain, you could remove your S-Bantoon from its holder and it had a tendency to de-escalate the situation. Do you know what an S-Bantoon is?
I don't. I'm guessing it's something you strike another with. Is that right?
Anywhere other than Baltimore, it's called a nightstick. But
okay,
in Baltimore history, it is called an S-Bantoon.
So. That's very advanced, Mike. Well, I think we recognize that strong, comprehensive, frequent training does not lead to an abolition of force used by the police, but it does show great promise in strengthening decision making in rapidly evolving situations and in the range of events that officers are involved with in this complex environment in which we police.
One thing I wanted to ask, I noticed on your resume you did a stint at the Police Foundation.
Well, I'm actually considered a fellow, okay. An executive fellow with the foundation, so it's more of an advisor.
Okay. But certainly familiar with.
Very.
Are you familiar with a study that they commissioned in Kansas City, the 1972-73 Preventive Patrol Experiment?
Yes, the Preventive Patrol Experiment really, yes, I am familiar. Yeah. And I believe what it talked about was that staffing in the presence of uniformed police officers and increased number of police officers did not dramatically affect crime rates.
Yeah, and what was powerful about it is, as a social scientist, which is what I am by training, you almost never get to do true experiments. And this was about as good as you get to do. There were 15 areas in the city. They were divided into three groups, five patrol beats in each group. They were chosen to be demographically matched. They pulled the police entirely out of one of these. They left normal patrol in the second one. And in the third group, they had saturation patrol. And about the only thing that I recall coming out of it that was different was that there was a modest increase in fear of crime in the areas that had the most heavy police presence. And after, in retrospect, you can figure how that happened. If you turn around, there's a police car everywhere. You turn around, there's somebody who is not going to know what the real level of crime is going to say, wow, we must be having problems here because every time I turn around, there's a police car. But what struck me about that is that kind of said that what up to that point was kind of the operative theory, what police should do when they're not taking a call, they should patrol conspicuously, and that will somehow deter crime. Well, that never was tested. And to the extent there's been a test, that this suggests that is not an effective strategy. So the question is, I have never seen much subsequent list, but it seems to me there's a whole bunch of time available. Has that changed what police officers are told to do in times when they're not taking a call? And you can give me a short answer. We'll pick this up after the break, but we'll give you, if you got a half answer, we'll give you a chance to fully answer later.
I think it's informed lightly, mm-hmm. but deeper dive in terms of academically valid mm-hmm. research needs to take place because there are some conflicts in the policing executive view mm-hmm. about this very thing. Some say that it has to be directed to certain activity. Others will argue that it has to be focused at specific areas where people either are experiencing heightened crime or experiencing a heightened fear of crime. But this study fights against it, doesn't it?
Well, and 40 years ago, I was hoping that by this time that would have been the first of many. And that, to me, is unfortunate. We'll return with you. We'll pick up this and other matters with Sylvia Moore, Police Chief, City of Tempe.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're talking policing issues with Tempe Police Chief Sylvia Moore. I asked you a long question and then I'll only give you 30 seconds to respond. The short version of the question was this Kansas City police experiment basically suggested that the time that police officers spend other than taking calls did not demonstrate efficacy of what in the business is called preventive patrol, which is police officers riding around conspicuously. The theory is bad guys will see them and they won't commit crimes.
Yeah, and you did also cite mm-hmm. that people did not experience a decrease in their fear of crime. Mm-hmm. We've had a different experience in Tempe. Folks say that they want to see more officers in their neighborhoods, that our officers are primarily going to and from calls for service on the arterials, the major streets in mm-hmm. Tempe. And they're saying that they feel more confident in the police. They feel a decrease in the fear of crime with the presence of what we call the uniform capable guardian. That is mm-hmm. a uniform police officer mm-hmm. in Tempe.
Probably true, but if you see too many police officers, then you start to scratch your head and say, wow, there must be a problem here.
Sure. What's going on at that house or in that neighborhood or in this space? Sure. People say that. I think some will argue that there needs to be more study in this area. Some would argue that evidence-based policing, hotspots, and all the other data that is coming into policing will help inform how we deploy officers, how we engage in officers being out in the community. Overall, people in Tempe feel more confident in the police when they're connected with a police officer and there's a partnership in how we address crime and the fear of crime.
You know, I wonder if there'd be even great sensitivity to the amount of visible patrol, given that we're in a suburban area and most of our houses are oriented towards the backyard.
They are. It's a very different environment.
It's not like a front stoop stool kind of city where if the police come by, you see them.
Sure. And that may really be a call to action to researchers. Hey, let's look at other types of neighborhoods, other types of urban environments to study this very thing that you highlighted that was studied many years ago in Kansas City.
And sadly, never really, to my knowledge, never really followed up on. It was certainly provocative. And, you know, that you have this situation where, you know, it's evolved the point where expectation of the police, 911, we expect sort of concierge services. You call, they come. Maybe even in a lot of cases when they shouldn't have to. Do you triage calls like that at all?
We do. Our 911 center, our call takers and dispatchers are incredible professionals that triage. They dive into asking good questions to identify if the police are the appropriate entity to respond. And Mike, we talk about this a lot, that the duties that police officers have to engage in today, very different than 30 years ago when I started and a few years before that when you were in policing, that in this failed social net, the police have been inserted into handling an array of problems that we are not really designed to handle.
There weren't traditionally. And that's evolved over time.
It has.
You know, I mean, if you go historically, police were there to preserve order.
Yes.
Which meant if things were in a public setting and we basically control. And then so the whole 911 notion, you know, if I have a problem, I call the police and they come to me. That was itself an evolution.
It was in the task.
And I want to ask about one thing, because I remember this is, again, comes back to, I want to know how much of this persists, but we would hear amongst my fellow officers, well, you know, I'm not a social worker. You know, that was, do you still hear that theme? Because it seems to me, to a very great extent, you are. Not to the extent, a social worker, somebody deals with stuff long term. Police officers deal with stuff in the kind of the immediate circumstance. They're not long-term solution, but very often you get, you know, domestic disputes, somebody gets beat up, you know, who are you going to call, right?
Sure.
You got to stop it, number one.
Sure. If we focus on our primary mission is to safeguard people, all people, it is to reduce crime and the fear of crime. If we look at that and then we examine what is the genesis for a fear of crime, and we couple it with historical perspective that the police have often been the reflexive muscle of the government. And we are the responders that go out and safeguard people. We have been inserted into a number of social issues, like we talked about a moment ago, that we have not traditionally been engaged in.
And a lot of times the reason is you're 24/7, 365, and nobody else is.
That coupled with a deep down desire to make a difference in the lives of people, that's who cops are. And so our officers are being asked to do an array of complex tasks that we have not asked of them before. I have not heard in the hallways or in the meetings that we're not social workers.
You haven't? No.
I haven't heard that recently because
good.
I think we recognize that we can address social issues as police officers and identify and deliver wraparound services to really care deeply to resolve problems. And problems are these really interesting things that are before us. They are computational. They are human. Problems are so as diverse as and unique as people. And cops want to fix stuff. We want to leave it better than we found it. So I think it's appropriate that we have identified that we not only safeguard people in a tactical kind of safety kinesthetic sense, there's also we safeguard people by connecting them with the right people that have expertise in some of these social issues.
I hear you saying that there's been a cultural change on that point.
There's been a significant cultural change. There's been a change because when other social programs are decreased, the police appropriately step in. Sometimes we are inserted where it may not be appropriate. There are some social issues that cops engage in across this nation that we are not the experts. We are a member of the team. Let's take homelessness, for instance. In homelessness in Tempe, the Human Services Division is the department that leads the effort. We are one of many that help to eradicate homelessness and those conditions that give rise to someone becoming homeless. Well, we're the first person. We're the first department that people call.
You're going to be on the scene.
Because we respond.
And you're dealing there with the nexus of poverty and or mental health and or any number of things.
An array of things that give rise to the conditions that where people find themselves homeless. And we are just a member of the team to decrease homelessness in Tempe. But folks often will call us to be the primary responder. And so what we're asking of police officers in this complex environment in which we police now is to operate in an array of environments with such precision and expertise. I wonder how long we can withstand that, how long we can meet the expectation that society has. It's very interesting.
Well, I guess my question or the response to that would be, where else are we going to go? There's nowhere. I mean,
right.
There can and should be a number of social agencies for long-term issues, but the 24/7, 365, that's the police.
Sure.
Right?
And we arrive and we restore order.
You figure out what it is, you know.
And then we connect folks with the right services for a longer-term resolution of the problems for which they found themselves in.
And you're saying that there's been sufficient cultural change that you're not having your officers say, "Hey, I'm a crime fighter. I don't do that."
Now, Mike, it would be a trap for me to say yes, because sure, I entered policing because I don't like bullies. Yeah. I don't like people who steal other people's stuff and pick on people. That's the crime fighting.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't like seeing people in despair. I want to comfort people in their time of need. It is not just a single focus. It's not a binary job. Policing is clearly the insertion of, I call it the insertion of the ampersand. Mm-hmm. It is not this or that. It is clearly this and that. And today's police officer is an incredible professional and can pivot from a tactical environment to a caregiving environment in an instant. They're incredible people that do it day after day after day to make their communities better. We found that in Tempe, and I think I've witnessed across this nation, cops are doing that in a lot of places. The nobility of policing, I think, is alive and well. It's just not the headline right now. So I think cops do that regularly and don't get the credit for doing it, not that they want it. But I think we're seeing a time where we're going to have a view from the outside that mirrors closely the view from the inside. And that is pride in the profession, men and women of integrity that provide service that is extraordinary.
You know, I think police probably carry this in identically to that of most public servants, which is when you do your job and you do it well, nobody notices. When somebody messes up, then it's page one news.
Sure.
You know, it's a lot of, you know, this anti-government, well, somebody made a mistake here. We forget the 10,000 planes that didn't crash, or, you know, the list goes on about, you name it, the water's clean, it's drinkable, I travel there.
Well, shouldn't we? I think we should.
We should. Yeah.
In some way, because if we consider that policing is a unique identity and we are given governmental authorities that are the most extreme in society to deprive someone of freedom by arresting them.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. It's a big, big deal and highly consequential to give a police officer the additional authority to use deadly force. Those are government authorities that police officers are given. So we have to continually strengthen. We have to train. We have to hold accountable, each of us in the profession. We have to evolve, and we have to engage in the difficult conversations. We do. And we do not do this job with exacting precision every time. And when we go outside of our training, when there's a gross deviation from our training, individual or systemic, we have got to hold ourselves accountable. And we do time and time again, but that part isn't really seen in the light of day all the time.
We'll talk in our final segment about some of those contentious issues when we return in just a minute with the Tempe Police Chief, Sylvia Moore.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Well, we're back with Police Chief Sylvia Moore of Tempe. We started to talk, hit around the edges of it, something that you can't get out of here without talking. The contentious issues, the officer shooting that doesn't look right, perhaps it's on body cam or not. This is where I think somebody like yourself is in the most difficult position. You got officers who I think expect support. I think I quoted to you privately the quote of an old fellow officer of mine said, you know, I don't need your support when I'm right. I need your support when I'm wrong. You got the public that I think, or at least some of it, wants you to be impartial. Politics. Issues of race and whatever can all come to play as well. asking you, as somebody who is an arbiter of the, how do you manage the conflict between the demands of an organization that expects your support and messages from the public that may be deviant from that in some respect?
Well, I anchor conception of leadership in the work of progress rather than in a concept of a transactional process of power and authority. I believe that folks will see, people will see internally and externally, if I'm operating outside of my values. I believe that people will see when we recognize that the facts will take us where the facts take us, and people don't want us to render judgment internally. Mm-hmm. Cops want a leader who will speak to the facts, will continue to stand strong and build our capacity for taking the heat, will be factual, will be void of judgment, and will support the profession of policing. I think when one individual operates outside of the norms and the values, people will make their own judgments. Mm-hmm. My responsibility is really to look at, are the outcomes consistent with our values? And that is a very important area for me to focus. In this country, every year, there are around 67 million face-to-face encounters between a police officer and a member of the community. Such a small number result in use of force. And the Washington Post, for instance, has been chronicling officer-involved shootings for quite some time. And there are just about 1,000 officer-involved shootings each year. Each one tragic.
Out of 60, yeah.
But, out of 67 but it's million.
It's the 1,000 that are potentially on page one.
They are. And I think people want honesty. They want a chief that will examine, did an individual so grossly deviate from training and they'll be held accountable? Are there systems that have failed, or are there systems that need to be strengthened? People want honesty, and they want people who are empathetic to the position that they hold. So I guess I see my role as being strong and honest and holding people accountable, as well as examining, is there strategy or policy that needs to be created to continue to refine this very complex and difficult profession that I'm in?
You know what I think can contribute to some of these circumstances? I think a lot of it is in the broader culture. The broader culture is saying, it's a dangerous world out there. There's people that hate cops. They're all over the, you know, they're, you know, They don't want you to go home to your family tonight. If that's in the culture, as some individual officer encounters an individual circumstances, that's a dynamic that's part of that, of what's going on.
It might be, and there are some people that are advocating for the abolition of police. And I wonder,
that's not going to go very far.
Well, there are some in high positions that are calling for the abolition of police, and I wonder who will step in between someone who wants to do harm and one that needs to be protected. I wonder who that is. I believe that we shouldn't take personal attacks personally, because when we do, we become the issue. And this, our recent kind of uprising through a tragic encounter of one of our officers and a young man with a replica pistol.
I specifically didn't go
you
there
didn't.
Specifically because I know that that's something is probably in litigation, whatever, and you're not going to be able to say very much about an individual circumstance.
I can say that it's tragic.
Of course.
It's tragic for that young man and his family. Yeah. It's tragic for the officer. It gives us an opportunity to examine how we show up for people and the decisions that we make.
And a lot of times I think a lot of people are prone to judge it with the wrong lens. The appropriate lens is what did the officer see at the moment, not what was uncovered afterwards.
Sure. You know? It's what we call the reasonable officer standard. Mm-hmm. And so under that reasonable officer standard, what he perceived at the time is very important. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to go into it too much, Mike, because it does cloud things. But we have a criminal investigation, administrative investigation. And at the end of this, we want to earn the trust of our community. We want to continue to strengthen individuals and our systems of training and carrying out the very difficult I guess, mission of policing in Tempe. And we want to hold ourselves and our organization and our profession accountable. And I think people expect that. And we have leaders across this nation that are willing to do that. We have some very courageous people that their actions demonstrate their values. And their actions, as I see in police chiefs across this nation, is we are increasing our capacity for taking the heat and further examining how we police in this very difficult and complex environment.
And as always, some of the worst cases occur in the infamously split second decision. And it's I think always appropriate to try to recreate that. But when you've got something on camera that you can slow down, that really isn't the point. That isn't the way things were perceived. Yes. in real time.
Yes, our responsibility is to examine how can we train to closely approximate those conditions, mm-hmm. coupled with, as we talked about earlier in the show, the mindfulness practices where officers can take in more data in this realm of situational awareness to take in an array of data and make more reasoned decisions, more precise decisions, given the heightened anxiety of self and the environment that they're in.
What do you think about the argument that such cases ought to be reviewed by some third party external to a department?
So, for instance, in Tempe, we have a citizen review board that examines this kind of situation. And so where we train an outside entity to understand the conditions of policing and the decision making and the tactics and an array of things, I think most of us in policing would support it. And in Tempe, we have that.
Yeah, that's been fought a lot, of course. I leave with the final thought, not in policing, but we're doing a focus group with a bunch of doctors in private, talking to one another. And I remember vividly the comment, you know, we haven't done a very good job of policing ourselves. That's physicians. So it's not an argument of professionalism. It's an argument of when you're within a group, there's some value to somebody taking a third party look at things. Sylvie Morg, Police Chief Tempe, thank you very much for joining us in the Think Tank.
Thank you for having me. Let's call them all.